Thanks for joining us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and today we talk about home improvement on the show. We'll focus a bit on outdoor living areas today, but we'll take other home improvement questions as well. Chad Spate back with us. He is the owner of Chad's Design Build in Monona and Madison. Chad, good to have you back.
Thanks, Larry. Always great to be here.
And with us as well, Tim Quigley. Tim is owner of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. Tim, thank you for joining in again. Good to have you here in the studio.
A pleasure to be here, Larry.
If you have a question about deck materials, let's say, maybe you'd like to know about constructing or staining a deck, you're thinking about other things like maybe a fire pit to your yard, or maybe you're thinking about some other home improvement project, we can cover pretty much all of it. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@wpr.org. I have a question for both of you, but Tim, we'll start with you. What are the most common outdoor projects your customers are talking about with you?
Yeah, actually, I was just talking to Chad about that before we came in. I'm getting a lot of requests for shaded areas and privacy screens. And in addition to that, then, the outdoor living is constantly evolving. People are spending more time outdoors and making it more living room realistic and also more dining room realistic.
That's interesting. Chad, what about you? What trends are you seeing? Is it kind of similar? Or?
Definitely. A lot of screen porch additions over the years. The demand for those has not slowed, and people are exploring ways to partially enclose screen porches at times. But yeah, outdoor living, of course, became very popular during the pandemic. So
yeah, absolutely. Well, a lot of those are in the back of the house, away from the street itself, I would think, oftentimes.
True.
But I'm thinking about the other end, the street end, and maybe curb appeal. Are there curb appeal projects that you're seeing out there when it comes to outdoor living spaces, Tim?
Well, 90% of our work is in the back of the house, but every now and again we'll get someone to want to update their front porch or maybe do a decorative fence. Mm-hmm. Not just so much a privacy fence, but just a boundary fence.
A boundary fence, yeah. You seeing that too, Chad, or at all?
Definitely, front porch additions are a part of the mix. And typically with a front porch addition, and this is true in Madison and some of the other Dane County municipalities, you can actually build a little bit closer to the street with a open front porch. The city updated the ordinances back a little over a decade ago to encourage community. People like to sit out on their front porch, and provided it's open, not enclosed, you can typically build 7 feet closer to the property line than what would otherwise be allowed for just, say, a stoop. So we have definitely built probably one or two front porch additions in any given year.
Yeah, it's interesting. And I love that concept. And I have a nice front porch, and I love sitting on that front porch because you get to see the neighbors and chat. Once in a while, they'll stop and have a drink in the evening or whatever. I really, really enjoy that. If you got a deck or a patio project, how long does it take pretty much to complete it?
Oh, that's a good question. Usually, a deck anywhere from 5 to 7 days, the ones that we do, the larger ones then, where there's more design involved, more complex, they can take 2, sometimes 3 weeks.
Yeah, I've looked online to your website. You do some fantastic designs for people. You've got some great photos on your site there, man. You did mention privacy, and if you live in town, you might not get a lot of privacy in your backyard. And homeowners might associations might ban fences. How could you use a deck or other outdoor feature to create a private backyard?
Yeah, there are homeowners associations. There's restrictions on the fences. What a lot of people are requesting, and also we suggest, build a privacy screening, semi-transparent, not fully private, on the side of the deck where the privacy is required. If you have neighbors that's living close,
10 feet away or something.
Yeah, and just build something there 5 to 6 feet tall, sometimes 4 feet tall, because if you just need the privacy when you're sitting down on the deck, it's not so much of an intrusion then.
And maintenance, how much maintenance does the, and maybe not necessarily what you just mentioned, but in general, how much maintenance do these decks and so forth need? Yeah, I'm thinking, I hated, actually, I got rid of my deck, my back on my lake home, because I got sick of having to restain the darn thing, and I had trouble with it. So I made a patio, brick patio. Also, I had raccoons and everything else going underneath the deck. Woodchucks. I think I trapped out 10 woodchucks out of my backyard over one summer period. And that's a lake home, but on Lake Monona in sure. Madison. So, but, and so I had no, you know, basically had no maintenance after that. But a deck, typically, what are we looking at?
Yeah, you're not alone there, Larry, with both the staining and the raccoons. Deck maintenance, with a cedar deck, they do require maintenance. They do require sanding and staining. The same with a pressure-treated deck. And the wood, and Chad could probably speak to this as well, the quality of the wood seems to be not what it used to be. So yeah. Instead of, when I started building decks, you put a good stain on there and it would last 4 to 5 years. Now it seems like it's lasting 1 to 2 years.
Yeah.
2 years if you're lucky. With the technology that's come out in composite decking boards now, there's mineral-based composite, PVC-based composites. There's really no maintenance on them. Still, I wouldn't call them maintenance-free because they do require, you know, hosing down or sweeping down every now and again, especially after the winter. And other than that, that's pretty much all that's required.
Yeah. Comment on that, Chad?
Yeah, I would just add a story. We had a client that about 15 years ago, we built a composite deck for them. And he called me up about 5 years ago after it had been there for 10 years and said, yeah. You know, I think that the boards are starting to fail on the deck. And I went out and looked at it, and it really just needed to be cleaned really thoroughly, you know, pressure wash. Because what happens is in the there's a grain that is embossed in a lot of the PVC decking material. And a little bit of particulate, dirt, matter, mm-hmm. you know, carbon matter will get in there. And it will then be a home for moss and things yeah. like that. So he had moss growing on the deck, but it was simply growing on the dirt that had accumulated in the grooves. And so we cleaned it off and it looked as good as new. So as Tim said, you know, a little cleaning can go a long way.
You know, I've got a leaf blower. A battery operated yeah. one, and it sits right by the front door. Leaves and so forth, whatever accumulates, I just go out there and turn that sucker on and blow it off and keep it clean out there.
Sure.
That does the job as well.
You can join in too, by the way. Number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org, zeroing in a little bit on decks and outdoor projects, but we can take other home renovation projects as well. Again, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Let's talk about, before we go to the phones, let's talk about a deck design for a minute. How does someone approach talking with a professional about having a deck built or redesigned?
Good question. First of all, if you establish your lifestyle around a deck, your lifestyle in the yard, your lifestyle in the house, do you like to entertain, or are you looking for something for just family? And the amount of people you think you would have it. A good rule of thumb for space for a deck is about 20 square feet per person. Now, that might sound like a lot of square footage for one person, but keep in mind you have patio furniture, you have grills and smokers these days.
Yeah, there gets to be, and tables.
Yeah.
Small tables and so forth. There gets to be a lot. So you got four people in the household. You're looking at what then? 800 square feet?
Yeah, 20 by 4.
20 by 4?
So,
oh, okay.
Yeah, 80 square feet, 80 to 100 square feet. It's always good to go a little bit bigger.
Yeah. Bigger is always, like the TV guy told me when he installed my, put my new TV in, I said, I wonder if this is going to be too big. And he said, I have never in my 20 years had somebody come and say, I wish I'd made it smaller, or I'd bought a smaller one.
Right.
Vivian in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Vivian.
Hello. One point, I had two properties to take care of, including a cabin up north with two sections of decking, 24 by 10, and then another one that might have been 5 or 6 feet by 10 or 12. And I didn't get those decks done as often as I would have liked. So when I did do them, I had sanding to do. I could not tell you what the wood was. I know it was not cedar. And after doing all the work with sanding, and the can said one coat, and I thought, I don't want to do all this work again, this prep work. So I called the customer service number, asked if I could put two coats on.
Vivian, just a second. Are we talking paint or stain here?
Stain.
Okay.
And it was a good quality stain. And, yes, you can put two coats on, but you have to put that second coat on very quickly before the first coat seals you out. So I did it in sections, maybe five boards, one length at a time, and then I'd start over on those same five boards. And that really worked well.
Yeah.
That's some great advice. And it is true that, I mean, every product is unique, and it's important to follow the instructions and take advantage of the customer service line to get that sort of advice. But I think it's a great point that often there are very few things that you can do with one coat and actually get long-term satisfactory results. And particularly when we're talking about a horizontal surface exposed to the elements in Wisconsin, because that wood is going to take a beating and be subjected to extreme conditions, both in temperature and moisture. So going the extra mile and doing a really good job of sealing the wood and protecting it is great advice the time.
Probably add another year or two to the amount of time that you would... you get to wait before you had to do it again.
Yeah. And if I might add what Chad has said, Vivian mentioned she needed to get the second coat on before the first coat dries. When you're staining a deck, and this would apply to anybody, the best time to do it is early in the morning when it's not so hot, or in the evening time when the house, when the deck is in the shade. So the best time to stain a deck is when it's not in full sun.
Oh, and that's it just is going to take better if it's, I got it. Okay. Vivian, thanks for that tip and information. Appreciate it very much. Ron in Land O'Lakes, we'll go to you. Hi, Ron.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I live up in Land O'Lakes on a lake, and I'm going to build a shed near the lake. So The area I'm building the shed sometimes sees some water after some heavy rains. So am I best to build the shed on those sonic tubes filled with cement, or should I just build them on those cement, like triangle or rectangle type blocks that you could put those 6x6s into? Because I heard that those sonic tubes with cement can shift if there's water in the ground. So I'm just trying to stream what I should build this deck on top of.
Yeah, so, well, that's a great question, and it's certainly going to depend on the particular soil conditions and whether or not it makes sense to consider putting an actual footing there for this, or whether you want it to just float pretty much at grade. You know, I would say the most important thing is to make it so that the water can pass under this structure, perhaps, if it is a wet environment, so that what you are supporting it on will allow some of that water to pass beneath it. Other than that, I'm not sure what advice I could give you. Maybe Tim would want to add something.
Yeah, Rod, I apologize. I forgot exactly what your question was. Explain the footing to me again. Were you wanting to go with the footing, or were you hoping to not go with footing?
I want to go on footings. I want to build it up, you know, maybe 6 inches, 8 inches off the ground. But I was reading that if I use the sonic tubes filled with cement, and it's not a lot of water, but when it rains, it does get moist in this area. So If I use those sonic tubes filled with cement, do they tend to shift when the soil stays wet, or I'm pretty good just to use the sonic tube, or do I use some type of cement blocks that they sell at the box stores that I could then build my deck on top of those, or my shed rather, not deck?
Yeah, without being familiar with your soil, if you go down below the frost line with the sonic tubes, you should be pretty good. But yet, at the same time, there's no real guarantee. But there's a couple of products on the market that you can use, and they're easy to install. And the first one, which is called a diamond pier, and they are easy to install. You can go to their website; they have videos. But then, if you want a little bit more security, there's also products called helical piers. You would need someone with a skid steer to come in and install them, because they're a screw that goes into the ground, and they're very secure. You're not going to have any issues with them, and so that's what I would say from there. So helical piers and diamond piers might be a good option for you.
And I would just add that, you know, whatever you put in, the connection points from the footing to the pier to the structure are really the key to stabilizing things. So that you don't want to skimp on those connection points.
Yeah, good points. Ron, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Visiting today with Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build, and Tim Quigley, owner of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. Give us a call with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Chad Spade and Tim Quigley. We're talking about a lot of things here relating to home renovation, but we've zeroed in a bit on decks. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. And just to mention, at 12:30 today, we'll talk about transforming your regular home into a smart home. That's at 12:30. In the meantime, let's go to Dawn in Wausau. Dawn, thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I have an uncovered wooden deck. It's about 15 years old. Like the a previous caller, I've been remiss in doing the yearly maintenance, so it's been about 4 years. I researched the recommendations by the manufacturer, It's an acrylate resin, so it's on ultraviolet cure. The manufacturers indicated on the website to clean with OxyClean, and then you could reapply the stain without sanding. So after doing that, I noticed that the wood has, the pigment is very splotchy throughout. And so before just slapping on the new, the same product as I had before, I thought I would test an area that was inconspicuous to see if it would look uneven. And that's definitely what occurred. So I'm wondering if you have any recommendations for what to do next, just to make it look even. And it's the same board that's splotchy. It's not like referring to an area that might have different exposure to the elements.
So the wood got splotchy when you did the cleaning, and when you tried to reseal it, you tested it, and it still looks splotchy. So how do you fix that? Is that correct, Dawn?
It's pretty close. It was actually splotchy, for lack of a better word, splotchy before I cleaned it, which is, you know, what told me I needed to redo it.
Yeah, so it's, of course, there are a lot of variables here, and so it sounds like you will probably have to resort to sanding the material, because I suspect that splotchiness is not something that's going to be resolved without doing that. I'm not aware of a product. I mean, we've dealt with splotchy wood, and typically sanding is part of that process of curing that. But it could be that there's a compatibility issue between the product you're using and the particular wood that's contributing to this. But again, there are a lot of variables. I wasn't clear on what type of wood you had, but it might be time to consider a slightly different treatment.
Yeah.
Yes, Dawn, do you know what kind of wood it is?
I don't offhand. I purchased the home with the deck. Is there a way to determine, like with the stamp, what the wood might be?
Not really. If you had a professional carpenter or contractor, they'd be able to tell what the wood is. But it's been our experience, pretty much what Chad said. You're pretty much going to get splotching, and the only way, and I'm afraid to give you the bad news here, is to sand it. Take it down to the bare wood, wash it off with acetone or something like that before you stain it, and that's pretty much the only guaranteed way that you're going to get it back to its original look without the splotches.
There you go, Dawn. Good luck with that. Appreciate your call. You got a little work ahead of you, a little elbow grease in your future, but it'll work. Mary in Mosinee, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Well, hi. I have a deck that I am also tired of restaining, and I saw a new product called Deck-End, and it's actually a plastic that goes over the boards, and you glue it into place. So it's a kind of a less expensive alternative to, like, the resin boards, the TimberTech boards that you can get. And I wondered if your guests had an opinion about that, if they had heard of that product.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mary. I have seen this product in promotional material, but we have never worked with it. And I have to say that I'm a little skeptical that, given the fact most decks are outside and that they're going to be exposed to a freeze-thaw condition throughout winter, that attaching some sort of veneer over top of wood, which is already an unstable material, that's going to have a good long-term finish, you know, and that it's something that you're likely to be satisfied with. I think that its low cost is a reflection of what you're going to get out of it, unfortunately. And I could be proven wrong on this, but I think it would be very hard for that to work out well. Having said that, TimberTech used to make a thinner decking material, but it was somewhat structurally sound, but it was designed to go directly over decking. But that had enough beef to it, and we never installed it, but it was a product that I was open to using. So the details would be important to understand here. I hope that's helpful, but I...
Mary, did that help?
Well, it does. I was going to try it out. I have a covered porch, but I also have an open deck. And so I was going to try it on the covered porch in a kind of a smaller area. This area is about 12 feet by 6 feet. And the cost would be about $300, so it's quite a bit less. And just to see how it would do, like you say, with the winter. Now, they claim that it stands up. What do you think would happen? Would it break?
Well, so my concern would be that the material, I assume it's some sort of synthetic material, is going to be, it can only bend a little bit as far as conforming to the surface beneath it. And the wood is likely to have a little bit of cupping or some variation in the, you know, it's not a purely level plane on which you would be adhering this new material. So that would be my concern. But I do like the way you're thinking about it. It could be that this is a good product to use in a more protected space. But I think you'll find that it holds up much better in that covered area than it might hold up if it's installed on the outside.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, and if I can add something, Chad mentioned earlier, with the wood, you have movement in it, it's unstable. You have moisture, you have the moisture soaking into the wood from underneath. So when you glue something to the top of that, you might have issues down the road with the moisture coming up through the deck boards and just lifting the glue off there. On the covered area, that's probably not going to be an issue, but on the open area, I would probably proceed with caution on that and do your research.
Yeah, for sure. Good luck, Mary. Let us know how it turns out. Appreciate your call. Lori in Oshkosh, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Lori.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We just built a deck, and it was built with treated lumber, and I'd like to paint it. Is there a certain amount of time that I should wait before I do that?
Yeah, great question. So typically, we would recommend about a month of allowing the deck to dry out. A lot of times a treated deck has a lot of chemical content in it, depending on how long it's been dried out at the lumberyard and in the curing process. But, when we work with treated lumber, sometimes you can tell it's very heavy, very dense with the chemicals. And you do want that to be able to dry out a bit before applying the stain. But if you wait about a month, that's typically sufficient if you're not experiencing particularly wet weather during that period. Certainly this spring in southern Wisconsin, it's been very wet. And so it's hard to proceed with projects like this because the material just hasn't been able to dry out. But that would be my recommendation. It used to be that this was 20, 30 years ago, the Forest Products Laboratory, which is actually based here in Madison, they used to recommend letting wood dry out for a year or so.
Yeah.
And they no longer... give that recommendation because of how damaging UV rays are to the wood. But it also depends on what the stain product is, and I would consult either the product and their recommendations, or possibly talk to a professional where you're purchasing the material to get some added tips on that.
And good luck. Thank you so much, Lori, for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@wpr.org. Taking a look, we zeroed in a lot on decks, but we'll take other home renovation questions as well. Again, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Tim, you use steel frame, steel framing, I should say, exclusively, pretty much, do you not? And what are the benefits of that?
Not exclusively. We do use it a lot. The benefits are you can have longer spans. You can span 20 feet versus 16 feet. The lifespan of it is probably, you know, the last deck you'll put on the house. So the real advantage of a steel deck, especially with the span, if you want to put a living area underneath, you don't have columns to contend with. And it also gives you a little bit more headroom, 3 inches. 3 inches might not sound like that much, but it is. It does make a difference.
Yeah. Well, all right. And and it's more expensive, I'm sure.
It is, yeah. It's about a third to 40% more.
Yeah. But if you're thinking of staying in that home for a long time, it sounds like it might be worth the cost.
Yeah, and with the new decking boards that are out now to come with, you know, pretty good warranties, you know, you might want to take a look at the investment and see if it's worth it.
Linda in Appleton, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Linda.
Hey, good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I just tuned in. I have a concrete pad, and you know, it's just outside patio doors, you know, where there's a picnic table, and it's very flat, has a couple cracks in it, which is, you know, immaterial. But it's been painted multiple times, and we're getting back down to the actual concrete, but there's still paint on there. Any suggestions how to clean that up to make it a little bit more, you know, pleasing?
So you want to get all the paint off. Is that what
I'd like to do that. Yes, and also, is there some kind of a protector under cover? It's in a very shaded area, you know. So at one time, my husband wanted to elevate it, but I said, you know, moss and everything is still going to grow underneath the Trex or whatever he wanted to put down there. But any suggestions as to a protective coating then as well?
Yeah, so there are some companies that specialize in coating concrete, and I would defer to their professional opinions on something like this because, again, there are a lot of variables, that concrete, any sort of a concrete patio is going to have a lot of moisture that's coming up from the ground, typically. And we have to be careful about trapping that moisture from being able to get out of the concrete. And so many times the finish that you'll put on an exterior piece of concrete is completely different chemically than what you might put on, say, a garage floor, which is more protected. So it's just not an area of expertise for me, but we have people that we bring in that help to consult with our clients on something like that. So those are the sorts of things that I would be concerned about.
Yeah, you see that, I see ads often for garage floors.
Right.
Fix your garage floor, but there you're inside.
Correct. And then what you do in a garage would be different than what you might do, say, in a finished basement, because the garage is not really within the envelope of the home. And there are materials that you might use there that you wouldn't want gassing off inside the home. So
yeah, and you'd want in a, well, just as an aside, in a garage, you'd certainly want, that's not going to let water through. So you'd want, you know, you drive your car in the garage and you got all kinds of snow on the bottom of it.
Right.
And it melts, in, and then it's just going to sit there unless there's some kind of way for the water to wash away.
Yeah, so, you know, what the pitch of the slab and whether or not water is going to sit on it or whether it's going to drain properly. I mean, these are all concerns that will contribute to whether or not a finish on that patio or on the slab will last as long as it might otherwise last if the conditions aren't good.
So. Yeah. Linda, there you go. Thank you so much for calling in. Good luck. Appreciate it. Nick in Wausau, let's go to you. Hi, Nick.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question about, so I'm always kind of doing it yourself with some of my outside spaces, and I have an interest in including solar, and I wanted to put solar on my roof, but the problem is the front of my house faces south. So I wanted to build a pergola up above my deck to get it up, you know, up a little bit, kind of even with the back roof line, so that way I could put solar panels on a pergola. And I was wondering if, you know, if you've seen any projects that try to incorporate solar or sort of decorative windmills, you know, some of these renewables in landscape projects, because I'd like to get ideas for that. I have a little pond in the backyard. I would like to get a decorative windmill and have it pump air into the pond, for example. Hmm. And I've looked around for, you know, for something like a decorative windmill that also is functional, and I haven't found one. And I'm wondering if those things are out there, or if they're coming, or if people are asking for that.
Yeah, so, well, these are great questions, and I will say that there is a growing market for small residential grade windmill devices, and mm-hmm. many times they're not shaped like an old-fashioned windmill. You know, they're
tubes sometimes.
Yes, like this, like a helical design that are very effective at catching the wind and also less threatening to birds and things like that. And they also can be rather small, but you know, it does require knowledge of how to install and operate, and that, you know, that's where we haven't had any experience with these. I've just looked into them to know what we might be able to recommend to clients who have these interests. As far as the issue of supporting solar panels on a structure like this, it's certainly possible to do that. But there you've got to consider the engineering. Obviously, the load of the panels and then the subsequent snow load that's going to be an issue for at least part of the winter. These are things that will have to be taken into consideration. And then there will also be a wind load on that structure that would not otherwise have been there once you bolt those solar panels to the top of it. So, you know, it's a lot to think about, and you certainly don't want to end up creating something that's a hazard, but it's possible, and it'll just be a little bit beefier, more engineered landscape feature.
Mm-hmm. There you go, Nick. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Chad Spade, our guest today, one of our guests. He owns Chad's Design Build in Madison and Monona. Tim Quigley of Quigley Decks, our guest today. You can call in. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll be visiting with Green Bay Botanical Gardens representative and actually horticulture manager Lindsay Hendricks. That's tomorrow on Garden Talk. Right now, we're taking a look at home renovation. We've zeroed in a bit on decks, and you can join in at 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Let's go to Dennis in Two Rivers next. Dennis, thank you for calling.
Hi, since you're talking about decks, the deck to me would be something long-term for somebody who wants to stay in a home. So So since many people end up with mobility issues, I suggest eventually or right away put a ramp on there, because the French doors with a low threshold is compatible with wheelchairs and walkers. And even if they end up moving out, well, a ramp could make it easier to move their stuff out.
Yeah. Tim, comment on that?
Yeah. Dennis makes a good point there. General rule of thumb when we're installing decks, the top of the deck floor is the same height as the floor on the inside of the house. So the only thing you have there is the door threshold. Now, it's common for different reasons people will want to keep the deck a little lower than the floor inside in the house. And for mobility purposes, you know, a ramp would work there, and something you'd have to maybe discuss with a builder, because there are codes that you need to adhere to as well as far as wheelchair ramps.
Go ahead,
and I was
Chad.
Just going to share with our listeners that you know, those codes, like, it is actually a very shallow pitch that you end up installing. For every foot of distance out, you can only drop an inch to have a ADA compliant ramp. And so if you're trying to get up 2 feet, that means you're going to need a 24 foot long ramp. And of course, you could have a ramp that is steeper than that, but it would not be an ADA compliant ramp. You know, it does take up a lot of real estate, but the caller is absolutely correct that planning for that ramp, even if you don't build it right away, would definitely be a good decision.
And Tim, I want to go back to you for a minute, because you had a comment that we didn't get to about installing solar system on a pergola.
Yeah, that was Dennis's question. Mm-hmm. Dennis, if you check with the solar manufacturer, check with their specs. They will have the specs for your pergola in order to be able to support the solar panels.
But it is done.
Yeah.
It definitely done. Okay. You can join in again, 800-642-1234. Here's an email from Jim in Ephraim. What kind of siding do you recommend for a home these days? They are considering re-siding their wood-sided ranch home, and there are so many choices.
Yeah, it's a great question. So, it really comes down to a variety of factors. There's the aesthetic. What do you want the house to look like? Do you want it to maintain a similar aesthetic? Right now, that wood siding could have anywhere from a 2.5 inch to more typically a 4, 6, or 8 inch reveal. And it's probably a horizontal siding. So if you want to mimic that, you could do it with a variety of materials. But then the question becomes, how durable do you want it to be? What about maintaining it? I imagine that Jim wants to move away from the wood, because you're constantly having to refinish it, either a stain or a paint, and then there's the potential for woodpecker damage and just general rot. The material that we use most often is something called smart siding, which does have wood chips in it. And some resins. It's a very dense and sturdy material. It's resource efficient. It is painted. You can get a factory applied finish that has a 25-year warranty on it. But you can repaint it, and because it's a very stable material, if it's properly cleaned and prepared before painting, that finish is going to last a long time. There are other products like cement siding, which have some advantages to them. Personally, I'm not a fan. I'm also not a fan of vinyl siding, for the simple fact that it is fairly fragile. It moves a lot, and it is the least paint-friendly product. You know, while there are some paints you can apply, I have never seen a vinyl paint job that, you know, withstood the test of time.
Yeah. So. We had smart siding on our lake home 15 years ago. I think it would be now at least that smart siding was put on somewhere around there. And and the house was painted yellow. Still looks, I drove by it, still looks good.
Yeah.
Still looks really good after at least 15 years.
Right.
So I liked it for sure. I want to talk about composite decks a little bit because we did get an email on that. They're certainly a popular type of deck because they combine two materials, wood and plastic. Pros and cons of going with composite?
Yeah, good questions. The pros, of course, is the low maintenance. Some of the cons, if it's in an area where there's high, where the sun is high in the sky, the darker colors can get quite hot. That would be the case with the wood plastic composites. The trade name for that is WPC. Now there are other products coming out on the market, and there's one that we've had success with. It's a mineral based composite. They don't get as hot, but then at the same time, the darker you go with the color, you are going to have that issue.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Is that your experience too, Chad?
Absolutely. Yeah, the color is the biggest thing that I was going to comment on as well. But, you know, and so synthetic decking, one of the drawbacks of it, if you're looking from a environmental perspective, they can be polluting to produce, depending on the particular material, and a lot of times you can't repair it if it gets broken or damaged. So we generally recommend you have a few boards if you can put them up in your garage or something like that. So if you're going to need to replace something, you can do that. But then the flip side is that it's going to last a long time if it's just cleaned, given the challenges of the climate we live in, we do a lot of the synthetic decking for our clients, sure.
Yeah, and if I can add to that, with the new, not new anymore, low-E windows, low-E patio doors, when the sun reflects off them doors, off the glass, it's hitting the deck, and it's increasing the temperature in that area by as much as 30, maybe 40%. I read an article in the National Association of Home Builders that talks about that. So an awning over the windows, a pergola, something to keep the sun off the window and the door makes a big difference.
Oh, yeah, that's something I hadn't thought about.
Occasionally, I mean, if the angles are just right, you'll see where like vinyl siding is melted on the side of an adjacent home or structure because of the reflection off of the windows. So it's definitely a real issue.
Wow. I guess that's something I hadn't even thought about. Our guests today, Chad Spate and Tim Quigley, and they're going to be with us right up until 12:30 today, and we'll take your calls, 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk home improvement on the show today with our guest, Chad Spade, owner of Chad's Design Build. With him, Tim Quigley, owner of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rail. Still time for your questions and lots of callers online, and we've got some emails, so we should get right to it, I think. Let's go to Bill in Oregon. Bill, thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a sizable gap between a two-foot-high deck and a limestone retaining wall. And because of the proximity of the property line, we can't extend the deck to the retaining wall, but we can fill that space with landscaping material. Now, the idea that I'm having is mounting some kind of durable material against the side of the deck, then putting 2 by 2 foot, 2-inch thick pavers standing vertically along that material, and then fill the far side with river stones. Now, if that sounds feasible, what material should I mount on the side of the deck? And if it doesn't sound feasible, I'd love to hear your recommendations on another way to do it.
Tim, what do you think?
Yeah, that sounds like a question more for a landscaper, I think. Were you planning on, so you weren't planning on expanding the deck, if I heard you correctly?
I can't.
Okay. So something to fill that void between the deck and the, what was that again?
The wall,
yeah. Unless Chad has some ideas, well, but I would refer that to a landscaper.
Could you clarify, Bill, like, so the retaining wall that's below the deck, I take it it's lower than the deck?
Well, the deck is 2 feet high. There's a retaining wall that runs about 3.5 feet away from it. And because of zoning and proximity, we're in Dane County, but we're not in Madison, so we have to stay 10 feet from the property line. So the deck literally ends 10 feet from the property line,
right.
And I want to extend that height out to the retaining wall, that 2 foot height.
Got it.
And the issue is, okay, how do I get landscaping material to abut up against the deck without damaging the deck?
Sure. So you're probably going to end up attaching something, to the pillars beneath the deck, or possibly even some sort of material attached underneath the framing to extend down to essentially allow you to put a like a privacy board around the bottom of the deck, and then potentially put material up against it. I mean, I would be concerned about rot and things like that. And of course, if you were to put stone in there and it was 2 feet high, I mean, there's a lot of weight there. I'd be worried about damaging the deck. These are the sorts of things I would be concerned about, but without actually seeing it, it's hard to give you a emphatic recommendation that I would say is safe or appropriate. But
I like Tim's idea of actually getting a landscaper in there to look
at. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That is a great suggestion.
Yeah, you want to be careful. there's no doubt about it, Bill.
Yeah.
Alan in Athens, your turn. Hi, Alan.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking my question. So I'm visiting my sister this summer, and I volunteered to help her with a couple of things, one of them being a stone patio that she would like to put in on the back side of her house. She has pressure-treated lumber decking around front and two sides, and then she just had pressure-treated stairing. I think it's 6 stairs that go down off the back side of the house. And she's got all of this fieldstone and granite, and I would say that it's kind of, I think it's maybe some shale that she could use for a stone patio. And I'm wondering if you might have some recommendations. Currently, what is there right now, or what was there, was a heavy grade, it was probably granite, with sand on the top of it that has been flattened out, because there was a stone elevated patio off the right off the back of the house. It was the same height as the door, but now that's dropped like whatever the height is for six stairs. So
no.
So this is this patio. Is there a patio there at the moment, or is it just bare ground?
It's sand with that aggregate underneath it, and it's and it tapers down to lawn. But right now it's staring, six stairs that go down off the back side of the house.
Okay. It sounds, again, this sounds like a good landscaper question as well, but I think what you would have to do is get everything out of there, and the thing with patios is the base underneath, because the patio itself is only as good as how the base is prepped, and you need to go down at least 8 to 10 inches, and then fill that in with limestone, compact it down, and then put your patio on top of that.
Yeah. That's so at least 8 inches now, did you say?
At least 8 inches, yeah.
Yeah. Alan, there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Just to kind of go along with something we've been getting at here is we had a question from Jeff. What if a homeowner is looking at a backyard project that involves perhaps a swimming pool and landscaping as well as a deck? How should the contractors work together, or should they work as separately as possible?
Definitely work together. Now, I'm not sure if he wants to hire these contractors individually. If you find a contract, a landscape contractor that you're comfortable with, ask him for recommendations for the deck contractor and for the pool contractor. And the other way around, if you find a deck contractor that you're comfortable with, ask him the same questions. As a deck builder, we work hand in hand with landscape contractors all the time. Not so much pool builders, they're kind of a separate entity, but from time to time we do have to work with pool builders.
But you wanna I like your idea of somebody you're confident in, of one of the three, and then have that person recommend the other people to work with, because they probably have worked with them in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes really good sense. Mark in New Lisbon, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, I have a question about the difference in the pros and cons of oil-based versus water-based stain for outside foot decks.
Oil-based versus water-based stains.
Yeah, Mark, I would. We don't do staining. We hardly ever do staining anymore. There's some good paint stores in your area that would be able to answer that question for you. And I mean the paint stores like Sherwin-Williams, Premier Paints here in McFarland, the independent paint stores.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, general rule of thumb, a lot of the water-based stains are more on the surface. They don't penetrate the wood as deeply as typically an oil-based paint. And so that's one of the advantages to an oil-based finish. It will just bond more with the actual wood. And provide a little bit more protection. But having said that, there are some excellent water-based products on the market. I'm more familiar with the interior wood finishes that we use all the time, water-based, that are as good, if not better, than some of the oil-based finishes. But for the exterior, I couldn't recommend a particular product that's water-based, but there are probably some decent ones out there, and I would agree with Tim's advice to go seek out a professional supplier that can stand behind their product.
Let's turn to Susan and Madison. Before we do that, you can join in, too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Susan, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have kind of an odd one for you. I have a 50s ranch house, one story, that had an addition put on somewhere in the 80s, I'm guessing. It was like a long room with an attached garage, but the garage does not have an opening to the room. So they share a common wall, and they share a flat roof, which is a rubber roof. The walls of the garage especially are really being attacked by woodpeckers, and the siding on the garage is super thin. It's like paper thin. I'm wondering if it would be a feasible thing to put aluminum siding over that to match the rest of the house, like the base of the house, to put aluminum siding over this room that was attached as well as the garage.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Susan. Barring not actually seeing this to potentially have some reservations, I would guess that you're probably fine in having some sort of aluminum or metal siding installed to match the rest of the home. And I imagine you're planning to hire a contractor to do that, or?
Yeah, I'm really in just the very basic how to kind of thinking about this.
Yeah, so, you know, there are companies that specialize in exterior siding installations, and so I would do a little research on that and find a qualified, highly regarded siding contractor who works with the materials that you're hoping to match, and then, you know, have the conversation with them. But I suspect that there would be no real issue with that. The only thing that could be an issue is the overhang, if there is an overhang with the flat roof addition that you're referencing. When you're adding material onto a structure, you want to make sure that it's protected.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Thank you, Susan, for calling. James in Fountain City, your turn. Hi, James.
Hi, thanks. Say, you know, I was a painting contractor for 35 years, and I've done my fair share of decks. I'm just commenting upon the caller there asking about water versus oil-based. I would highly recommend using an oil-based stain on that and make sure that it's solid color and not semi-transparent. It'll be much more durable, and he's got to try to apply it in shade if at all possible. Give that product a time to soak into the wood and dry slowly.
Yeah.
Yeah, those are great comments.
Great comments. James, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We had Leslie and Racine. They have an open wood porch that gets Lake Michigan wind and Wisconsin winters and a lot of use. So they end up scraping, sanding, priming, and painting with a porch paint every year. Is there anything besides replacing that they can do to get a year break, or should they just add this maintenance to the calendar every year?
Good question. Too bad if we didn't get our question before James called in. Again, I would refer to a paint supplier. You can sand it. You know, when you sand it down to the bare wood, yeah. And as both James and Chad said, an oil-based stain or paint. But that's about the extent of my knowledge on that.
Yeah.
And the one thing that I just want to mention, when we're sanding wood, we do have to be very careful and use protective equipment, because there are all sorts of potentially hazardous materials in some of the finishes that might be on the on the wood currently that we're removing. So, of course, obviously, if it's an older home, you could be interacting with lead-based paint. It's those sorts of hazards that we have to be mindful of. And, of course, a lot of our listeners are do-it-yourselfers, and just be careful out there.
Yeah. It adds a lot to the price of painting when you have to add in an old paint that may be lead paint, or if there are lead-based paints, because there's quite a procedure that has to be done to get rid of that paint first.
Correct. And Tim made this comment earlier about, you know, preparing for any landscaping work with, you know, putting in a proper base so that you have a satisfactory patio at the end that's going to hold up and perform. This is, of course, true of any painting or staining. You know, preparation is 80% of the work. So,
Greg in Belleville, will go on to you now. Greg, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I live in on a heavily wooded lot. I have a deck that surrounds a hot tub. There are stairs up to the hot tub, and then those stairs continue up to the second floor of the house. So both vertical and horizontal surfaces that I have to worry about. The deck hasn't been stained for a number of years. It's a red stain that was put on there that I've always hated. So my question is, what do I do to cover the horizontal surfaces that are badly bleached out and, you know, essentially lacking color? And something that will also cover the red that I don't like on the vertical surface.
Well,
yeah. If you feel like sanding, you know, that's probably my quickest and easiest answer. But if you get a paint, well, obviously you'll have to sand it down anyway. But if you don't want to sand that paint off it, another paint should do it. And again, I'll throw that question over to Chad.
Yeah, it's just, you know, preparation. I mean, obviously making sure that this older structure, that the materials are sound. There might be some boards that need to be replaced. And then, you know, the caller's suggestion about using a, you know, solid stain, a solid pigment stain or paint. I mean, that is true. I mean, if you're looking to go over different colored materials and old finishes, that's really going to be the only way you're going to get a more uniform and satisfactory finish. And so it might be possible to just clean some of these surfaces and then reapply a paint of your choosing.
Yeah. There you go, Greg. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. I want to, you know, we haven't mentioned railings at all. I really wanted to mention railings because I like these cable railings a lot. And Tim, you use them a lot. Maybe describe what this railing looks like on a deck and talk about its advantages.
Yeah, the stainless steel cable railing. It is posts that are upright, anywhere between 3 and 4 feet with a top rail on top of it, and then the 1/8-inch stainless steel cables running from end to end, which are tensioned. The real beauty of them is it really opens up the landscape. It doesn't block your view. And also we have discovered through the years as well, if you have a small backyard, the cable railing is it's there in your backyard and you don't even notice it. It's not overpowering the space.
Yeah, it's a great thing. I used it indoors on the lake home. I had a second floor bedroom that looked out right onto Lake Monona, but there was on the first floor there was another room that went out, so I was kind of, you would look down at the, you needed a railing or you were going to fall a floor, and we went with the cable railing and you could lay in bed and look out on Lake Monona.
Yeah, we do a lot of interior installations.
Do
on,
you
on them as well? Yeah,
I really, really liked it.
Well, and, you know, Larry, Tim was mentioning earlier that he's got a client that he's putting cable railing up essentially for a fence in the yard. And it had never really occurred to me that, you know, you could just put in a cable rail fence as a, you know, way to keep in a pet or just define your space and not block the view.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a house with a lake view. She doesn't like the invisible fence for the dogs. She's got two dogs. She doesn't want to take away from the view of the lake. And so the cable railing
the perfect solution then to that. Man, we have a couple of more questions here. One, Robin emailed us, this is a permeable driveway. Are they a good alternative to concrete in Wisconsin climates? What are the benefits and drawbacks, perhaps, of a permeable driveway?
So the biggest drawback is just going to be the cost, probably, because it is possible to have a permeable concrete or a paver system that is permeable installed. They do tend to be a little more expensive, but they are going to allow the water to not just run off of the surface, but to also be partially absorbed into the ground. And so that helps reduce runoff and just keep our lakes healthier, because that runoff ends up in a lake somewhere.
Yeah, we have one in our neighborhood that it looks nice. And the water's simply, you know, it's not going to just go rushing off.
Right.
And it does look nice. Bill in Rice Lake wondered, Tim, if you could recommend the specific deck material if you were going to put it on your own place. What specific decking material do you think is best?
If you wanted to go for wood and something that's pretty much maintenance-free, Ipe, which is Brazilian mahogany, don't stain it, and it has an outdoor lifespan, I think, of 70 years, something like that. If you want something then with more designer colors, there's a lot of composite decking boards out there. Decorators is one that comes to mind. And there's a new product now available in Wisconsin called Wolf Decking.
Wolf Decking?
Wolf.
Wolf, as in the dog, like the...
Wolf Decking. And there's... And they have... Wolf and AZAC, which is owned by TimberTech, and they have decking boards that's almost identical to a wood grain. They're very close.
Well, you guys, it has been a pleasure. I want to thank you so much for being with us today, and we'll look forward to another visit. Thank you both.
Thanks,
Tim
Larry.
And Chad.
Always
thank
great
you.
To be here.
Appreciate it very much. Chad Spade is owner of Chad's Design Build. Monona and Madison, Tim Quigley, owner of Quigley Decks and Quigley Cable Rails. Great to have both of them with us, and we'll do it again down the road here. Coming up, I'm going to tell you how to make your home really smart. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, we've been hearing more and more about smart homes, and we're going to take a look at that, a little closer look at that on the show right now with our guest, George Webster. George is a general manager of Cease Electronics, works out of Appleton, and we'll talk with him about how his company is making all sorts of homes smart. And we're talking here both new and old construction. So, question for you. Which smart home devices do you have in your home? Do you have maybe a smart speaker? Maybe you got a Nest thermostat? Or how about a robot vacuum? Maybe you're interested in making your home smarter. I think most of us are. Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. George Webster, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. How are you?
I'm doing just great. What's the definition of a smart home?
Well, what a smart home is not is going to a hardware store and purchasing a Wi-Fi light bulb or smart thermostat or a door lock or something. And instead, a smart home needs to be a way that we integrate the technology we already have in our homes, but make it so that it's easy to use and that the whole family can use it, not just the one smart person in the family that figured it all out. And that's the key. Just about everything has an app today, but what if we could say, instead of having a phone full of apps, what if we could have a single app that rules them all, where the house actually anticipates our needs and takes repetitive things that we do every day and simplifies it? That's really what the definition of a smart home is.
Man. And we can automate a whole lot of things in our homes, can't we? I mean, what all can we automate?
Sure. Technologies that we probably already have in our homes, such as security, lighting, whole house music, entertainment, intercom, heating and air conditioning. All those technologies are things that most of us already have in our homes, but they're not integrated. They don't talk to each other. They're not smart. And a modern smart home, you know, the analogy I like to make is it should be like our modern cars. If you, probably everyone who's listening just about has a car that, you know, has a centralized air conditioning system. You set it to 70 and it figures out whether it needs to run the heat or the air conditioning. The door, the lights turn on if it's dark out, and they turn off when you turn the car off. You have a centralized sound system in the car. We're simply taking those technologies that we already take for granted in our lives. I don't know, you can buy a car that doesn't have those technologies, and we're taking it and adding it to our homes. And it's actually kind of interesting that more people don't actually look at it that way and realize that our homes are actually quite dumb, whether it's a new home that's being built or an existing home. Yet we have these technologies in our home. We're just not integrating them well.
Yeah, and well, it's, you know, I'm thinking about my own home for just a minute here. Now, I've got a climate system in the house where it's a three-story home, and so I've got what they call zone heating and cooling.
Yep.
So the top floor is a whole lot different from the first floor when it, you know, like on a summer day, it's going to be a lot hotter in the up there. Could a smart home take into account three levels?
Well, your home probably has thermostats in those extra.
Yes.
You said you had three stories, and yes, absolutely. So the way to look at it is this. We do things repetitively throughout our lives, living our lives. For example, we leave for work, and we have to remember to turn down those thermostats or turn them up depending on the time of year. But how many of us do actually remember to do that? Well, a smart home should not only be able to manage your home like that in terms of the HVAC control, but it should be able to automatically set that back as you leave. And then as you come home, to recognize that you've come home and turn the air back up or turn the heat back up. So you're not, you see, a smart home can be a sustainable home, can be a green home. And the whole goal is to take technologies we already take for granted in our homes, and we're just making them simple and easy to operate.
Gosh, how'd you get into this business, George?
Well, yeah, I've worked for Cease Electronics here in Appleton. I just celebrated 25 years. I've been in the industry for about 30, and it's one of those things that I don't know that any of us or many of us actually plan on what we're going to be doing in our lives, right? And it's just one of those things that I find technology fun and interesting. It changes. It's always evolving. And I found an employer that, I don't go hungry. I have plenty to do. I have new technology to keep me interested in. After a while, you just keep on keeping on. It's what you've done pretty much all your adult life after a while.
Yeah. I can just speak to that. I've been doing the same thing for a long, long time here myself. How popular are these smart features? Obviously, you're busy, so are you seeing more of these smart features being installed?
We are, and what's neat is the type of system that we're typically putting into people's homes are a company's system called Control 4, and it's a modular system. What that means is, let's say you have interest in securing your home with smart locks, or you have interest in controlling the heating and air conditioning with a smart thermostat, or perhaps lighting control, the ability to control your lights. But let's say you don't have any interest in whole house music, or maybe you don't have much for television or something like that. You can get just the parts of the system that you find interesting and add on to it later. Years ago, we were one of the first dealers in the area to provide smart homes back in the mid-1990s. And at that time, it was only for new homes. So if you weren't building a home, we're sorry. You know, there's nothing we can do. Where the systems today, especially by this Control 4, have the ability to be integrated not only into new homes that are being built today, but also an existing home. I live in a home that's literally more than 100 years old, and I can integrate these systems into my home. It's not needed to be a new home construction. It can be existing homes.
Vern called, couldn't stay with us. He's wondering, he's worried about security protections that smart homes have so that they don't get hacked. And it also seems like the simpler things are, the less likely they are to break. So he's kind of worried about that, too.
Right. Well, from a security perspective, that's a great question. I'm glad that he brought it up. The systems that we provide are rock-solid security. That's not a concern. But here's where it becomes a concern. All these systems are password-protected. And we have a habit as a society of reusing the same passwords or making easy-to-guess passwords, you know, your kids' birthdays or Go Pack One or something like that. So a strong password is always important. But also, these systems, Larry, run on a particular type of fuel. And that fuel is the network, the wired and wireless network that's in your home. And when you're working with a smart home pro, such as our company, we're also providing world-class Wi-Fi and secure networking so that the back doors or the ports that maybe a hacker or somebody could possibly get into is being managed by the people that know what they're doing. And at the end of the day, these systems are very secure, and it's not something to be worried about.
John wants to know which system seemed to be the most popular.
Well, again, our company provides Control 4, which is an American company out of Salt Lake City. And we've sold their products for decades at this point, or at least since the early 2000s. And so from our perspective, that's very popular. There are other brands of companies that do it. But early on, I mentioned that I think sometimes people interpret a smart home as going to the hardware store on a rainy Saturday and buying a smart light bulb that you connect to the Wi-Fi or a door lock or a you know, a thermostat or something, and you end up with a phone full of apps. It's the equivalent of having a coffee table full of remotes. No one really knows how to make it all work. And I don't look at that as a smart home. I look at that as just maybe smart devices in a normal home. And really what happens is you end up with too many separate devices, too many apps. It's not easy to use. And that's the antithesis of the type of product that a smart home pro such as our company provides.
I'm wondering about the difficulty. I mean, I can see it would be, well, comparatively easy. Let me put it that way. If you're building a new home,
mm-hmm.
But how difficult is it to put in automation like this into an existing home?
It's not difficult. But it does require replacing, let's say we were interested in putting some smart lights in someone's home. So the physical wiring that's in the house stays, the physical fixtures in the house stay, so the light fixtures, the chandelier, the recessed lighting, et cetera. But instead, the light switches themselves get changed to smart light switches. And they still operate like a light switch. They still use the same wiring that the old light switch did. But instead now, the light switch is connected to the central processor or brain of the system. And then that central processor knows where it is on Earth. It knows when the sun will set. It knows when the sun will rise. It knows what time of day it is. And then we set the system. So, for instance, you are coming home from work. Something that all of us do several times a week. We have an armful of groceries. We unlock the door, and we're trying to walk into a darkened home with an armload of groceries, trying to turn on lights with our elbows. Instead, a smart lighting system like this, whether it's retrofitted into an existing home or it's a new home, as you unlock the door, the house knows it's you. It turns on a pathway of lights to the kitchen. It sets the heat, it turns the heat up, or it sets the air up. It turns off the security system. All you did was unlock the door with your code. And so these sort of things can be done in existing homes or with new homes.
Yeah. What? I'm going to ask you about costs, or have you think about costs for a minute. George Webster is our guest today, and he's general manager of Cease Electronics in Appleton. And I will tell you, Cease is spelled S-U-E-S-S, Cease Electronics in Appleton. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. Coming up tomorrow on Garden Talk, we'll be visiting with the Green Bay Botanical Gardens folks. You'll get some top advice about your annuals from horticulture manager Lindsay Hendricks. That's tomorrow at 11. Right now, we're talking about how to make your home a smart home. And you can join in, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. Skip in Harshaw has a question for you, George. Let's go there. Hi, Skip.
Hi. So we built a home 5 years ago, and not thinking properly. I only put speakers in the grate for the...
Oh, Skip, we lost Skip. He only put speakers in his house in the great room.
Sure.
And I mean, he wants it through the house.
Right. I think I can finish his question. Unfortunately, it sounds like his call dropped. Is that there are wireless speakers today. Now, a dirty little secret, there's still a wire plugs in for power until they invent wireless power. Things are always going to have a plug-in for power, right? But there are such things as wireless speakers made by manufacturers such as Sonos, Denon, Yamaha, others, that can be placed, on a nightstand in a bedroom or on the countertop in the bathroom or maybe in the, next to the toaster in the kitchen, that allow you to link them together to listen to your music or Wisconsin Public Radio, let's say. And my mom, who's in her 70s, has a system like that. She has an older home. Rather than the enormous cost of trying to retrofit speaker wire through the house, we ended up recommending that she use these wireless speakers. And again, they just plug in locally for power. And she just hits a single button, and she does listen to Wisconsin Public Radio. And every morning she gets up, she hits the button, and all three rooms of her house that she's interested in has this music playing. So there's really no labor or any effort or any construction to install something like this. Instead, it's just literally a wireless speaker that plugs in. But the key behind all this is it needs to have a quality network. I mentioned this before. This is the fuel that these systems run on. So, unfortunately, sometimes people have their router they bought in 1997, and they're still using it literally decades later. And that sort of thing is probably not going to be happy with the modern wireless speaker system. So be aware that it's probably important to have good, strong Wi-Fi in your house as well.
So what do you do when you go to somebody's house? Somebody says, I really want to make my house a smart house. What's the process like for you? You must have to go and sit down with a person and talk with them about what their needs are, I would think.
Well, it actually is different than that. Here in Appleton, we have a 33,000-square-foot facility. 22,000 square feet of it is showroom. And we've actually built a model home, a 1,200 square foot model home in the middle of our showroom. Because what we find, Larry, is this sort of technology is very difficult to understand just by talking about it, albeit we're talking about it now. It's much easier to show someone in person. So we have a great room, we have a kitchen, we have a dining room, we have a fake basement, we have a den, and it shows off the various bits of technology that one can integrate into their homes. I can put the remote in the customer's hand, or I can show them what I mean by smart lighting, or I can discuss simplifying the entertainment system, or what whole house music means, and how would it look, and how does it sound. And so oftentimes we're meeting with our clients here in our showroom so that we can show them these things. We think that's a much more powerful way of doing it than, you know, referring to a picture of a project you did once and or just simply discussing about arcane subjects and instead just demonstrating it in person. I think that's the best way to do it, and that's how we've choose to do it, and it seems to work well.
Yeah, it makes really good sense. Ed in Northern Illinois wants to know how much it would cost for an install. He said, is this going to cost $100,000, or there are sort of options that people who can't afford the high cost work with?
Well, it's like asking how much does a car cost. I think most of us say, well, a car costs X or Y. Well, the reality is a car could be the $500 rusty jalopy that's being sold in the corner, or it could be $1 million Bugatti, you know, supercar or something like that, and everywhere in between. So these sort of systems are affordable. We are installing them all the time, but they also can be very expensive if the homeowner is interested in it's a large home with a lot of integration. I suppose it can get expensive. But the best part of all is that it's piecemeal. It's modular. You can do just the parts that you want. For instance, if we presented a proposal that said it was going to be X to do the smart lighting in someone's house, and they said, well, you know, I can afford that, but I'm not going to. I have to buy cabinets or something else. Well, then we just do, let's say, the main living area, or we just do the kitchen and the pathway in from the mudroom and the garage. And then next year, the year after, we're adding additional parts in to round out the system. So it can be a build-up approach. And frankly, most technology in our lives can be expensive at first blush. We all have smartphones in our pockets now. A smartphone's $1,000. Would any of us 20 years ago imagine spending $1,000 every couple of years to buy a new smartphone? Well, no. But we can't live without them either, right? So it's a matter of understanding that this isn't something that's just fun or interesting or hobbyists. This is designed to simplify and change our lives. The analogy that I made about the vehicle having this sort of technology, in fact, my parents had a car in 1984. I remember growing up in the 1980s that the lights came automatically, turned on when it was dark, and they turned off when you got out of the car. And, you know, that sort of technology becomes acceptable and therefore affordable over time.
Here's an interesting question from Judy in Fitchburg. Does your company also tell prospective customers about the Inflation Reduction Act and the financial benefits of electrifying so many home systems?
Well, I don't know anything about the Inflation Reduction Act, so I can't speak on that. But she does bring up a point that I think is important, and I briefly mentioned it before, that a smart home is a sustainable home. Is when we are, what I mean by that is the automation is when you leave the home that the lights turn off and the thermostat sets back. If you had a fireplace, the fireplace turns off, et cetera. So from that perspective, a smart home can save people money just on their utility costs, but also, it's better for the earth. Even though individually it might only be a little bit of money that you're saving, you multiply that by every home and it becomes a real number.
Yeah, have you ever done the math on it, how much a smart home could help save money on your energy bills?
Well, we have. Here's an example. We put in a smart lighting system. We rarely run the lights at 100%. Instead, we tell the system that when someone turns on the light to turn it on to 90%, the human eye doesn't perceive the difference between 90% and 100% of light very well. To us, it's as bright as it needs to be. But yet, because we're running the lights at 90% less, or at 10% less power, you're saving 10% less electricity, right?
Sure.
Right? So from that perspective, that's easy math. You know, you automatically are spending less, 10% less on your lighting because of the smart lighting being set only to 90%.
Here's another question in relation to speakers. This goes back to our earlier. Can you get speakers to work together for this? Somebody else wonders, can you get speakers to work together for surround sound, or will multiple speakers all output the same kind of basic sound?
So generally when we're putting a house wide sound system in, or whole house sound system in, whether they're wireless speakers or a wired speaker, it is set up so that it is what's called multi-zone. So that means that you have the Packer game on in the great room. You have people over, so you have the grill going out on the deck. So therefore, at the same time as the Packers playing in the great room, you have the play-by-play over the air that's, say, playing out on the deck. And maybe the kids are not interested in the football, so they're down in the basement playing video games or something. They could be listening to yet a third type of music downstairs all at the same time. So a multi-zone system does allow you to have a house full of music, and it can be the same thing everywhere, or it can be individual dad's music, mom's music, kids' music, etc. It's a great question.
Yeah, and so there's a button downstairs to push if you want a certain kind of thing, or how does that work?
Right, so that's a great question. So what you're referring to is interface. So how does one interface with their home? Well, there's multiple ways to do that. It could be through an app on your smartphone. It could be through a touchscreen that's on the wall or a keypad that's on the wall. It can be through voice. Some of our smart home systems, you literally say, turn on, ESPN, and the TV turns on and goes to ESPN. So there's the goal is ease and simplicity, not complexity. These are not really intended for hobbyists, although happy to help people that are interested from a hobby perspective. These are intended for every person. And who wants to fight with a handful of remotes or the difficulty of running things? So the whole goal of these systems is simplicity and to make our lives easier, not to make them more complex.
Yeah. So I'm wondering, actually, I would think that this smart technology could have some effect on resale value of a home.
I think so. It's common for people to contact us that say that they bought, Dr. Smith's home or whatever, that we would have put one of these systems in, some years ago when they bought the house, and I'll come over and introduce the our company to them, and that we'd be their point of contact, their guy, so to speak, if they have mm-hmm. questions. We decommission the system from the previous owner and commission it for them so that their music streaming services are in their name, not in the former owner's name, and go over operation. And it's actually a common thing, and it does help with resale value, in the sense that who wouldn't want one of these things?
For sure. So, but the main goal, it sounds like the main thing is that control system, that Control 4 system that you mm-hmm. use.
Yeah. Yes, right. Control 4, Salt Lake City. It's early on, smart home systems were only for new construction. And Control 4 looked at it and said, when you take off in an airplane and you're kind of looking down on your city as you're flying out to wherever you're going, and you look down to all the homes that you can see as you take off the airport, how many of those homes do you see that are new being built now? Very few. How many homes are existing homes that you see? All of them. And they're looking at it saying, why should we limit ourselves to just the people that are building a new home? It should be something that we can integrate with all homes.
It sounds like a really good operation. And you have a website, do you not, George?
Yes, we do, ceaseelectronics.com. And cease is spelled unusually. It's spelled S-U-E-S-S, ceaseelectronics.com. And our company has been in business. It'll be 74 years this summer. And I've worked here 25 years of that 74 years. So.
George, yeah. A great pleasure talking with you today. I learned a lot in a very short time, and I appreciate your time, and maybe we can do this again. Thank you.
Thank you.
George Webster, General Manager of Cease Electronics. Great to have him with us. Appreciate his time very much. Man, it sounds like a wonderful thing to do to a home. And I want to thank you for listening in. It's a big team effort here. Our producers, Clara Neipert and Joel Patnod. Our technical directors, Lee Rayburn and Jeff Robbins. And, of course, our executive director is Jill Nadeau. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to WPR News. And stay with us. Lots more in store.